Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Video Games Now podcast. It's Rodney, joined by Will.
Hey, I'm back.
Yes, you were under the weather for quite some time.
Blame work.
It's all about work. Speaking of work, we got a cool-ass dude here today named Curtis. He's the quality assurance manager at Kabam Games. And Mr. Curtis, hello.
I'm good, thanks. How's it going? It's actually Kabam Games.
Oh, how silly of me. Kabam. 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 All right, I will probably butcher that about another 12 times in the whole podcast, so it'll be a good time.
We always tell people just think of a bomb going off.
Bam. Like a Wile E. Coyote like bomb or something, yeah.
Yeah.
At least you won't butcher the name as bad as you do Japanese.
Yeah, I can't say Japanese people's names to save my life. So it'll be much easier than that for sure. So we're going to talk about Curtis's job as a quality assurance manager, some of the things he does, and we'll talk about some of the games he's worked on, and he'll tell us some stories. It'll be a good podcast here. So here we go. All that coming up right now.
Right now.
All right, so working at Kabam Games, it seems to be a good time. I was checking out some pictures online, and the office actually looks really cool, and they have a craft service there.
We do. We got a candy walls. We got beer on tap.
What? You have beer on tap? Dude.
We do. We just put in a kombucha tap and a cold brew as well.
Well, we're in the wrong business
for everybody.
Here.
Yeah.
We're in the wrong business.
So we have a crafty, but there's nothing like that. They don't have like a open bar beer on tap. They have like, if you're lucky, some brownies. So.
And your lunch can sometimes kill you.
Yeah, Will got food poisoning. I think was it last week.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So
don't trust the ginger beef.
Yeah, ginger beef's a no go. All right, so hey Curtis, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at Kabam Games?
Sure. So I've been working in the video game industry for about 10 years. I've been in the QA side of games that entire time. Worked at a few different studios, some big companies like EA Games here in Vancouver, BioWare in Edmonton, Microsoft, Radical Entertainment, and then I've spent the last 5 years at Kabam as the QA manager.
Very nice, very nice. And so for those of you who are listening to this podcast who don't know what QA is, you should not be listening to this podcast because you're not a gamer. So, yeah, you should just Google that right now. Just Google it. I'll just leave it at that. All right, so Kabam Games mainly works on mobile. So how is that, working on mobile games versus console and PC?
It's a lot different. I kind of was a little hesitant when I made the switch over, mostly because I'd never heard of Kabam Games before, but... what's really nice is most kind of AAA games, you're working on a project for 2 to maybe even 5 years, and then you ship it, it's out the door, you walk away, you take some time to reflect, and then move into the next project. Where mobile, your game is live and you're constantly supporting it. So every month you're putting out a new release that's just putting in new content for people to play. So you're just constantly moving. There's really no slowing down. So if you need to make any major changes, you kind of have to do it on the fly. Learn to like adapt and get it done.
Nice. I feel like the console market's doing that now too. They just kind of release a live game and they're like, hey, let's just fix all the problems now.
Yeah, you see a lot of studios doing that kind of game as a service, which kind of has a bad...
It leaves a bad taste in gamers' mouths, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of people frown on it.
Yeah, so just before we came on the air, we were talking about Anthem, and we share some similar issues with that game.
Yeah, it's a frustrating game to play sometimes. I really enjoy the being in a javelin, flying around, blowing stuff up with my friends, and then our joke is the actual real boss of that game is having to go back to Fort Tarsus and slowly float around talking to people for no reason.
Yep. Will, have you actually played the game yet?
I have not. I bought it. It's just been sitting on the console. That's about it.
I mean, it's not helping you that we're like shitting all over the game.
I'll play it sooner or later, right? It can't be any worse than Destiny for me.
Yeah, you're right.
Can it?
Yeah, well...
they got more stuff to do with Destiny right now than I think Anthem.
Yeah,
but they've had longer time to keep Destiny going. So, yeah. And I trust BioWare. They're usually pretty good with content.
I don't know, yeah. They kind of missed the ball on this one, for sure. We're kind of talking about Anthem again, but I mean, they don't have multiplayer. They don't have... I don't know. They're just missing a lot. They're missing a lot.
That's
that
all stuff, though. They said that's going to be coming to the game after launch.
Yeah, I know. But again, you're kind of releasing a game that's not ready. Then, you know what I mean? Like it's pretty well the same as the beta in a way, other than you start at level 1 instead of level 10.
Yeah, and I think by the time they even have some content, like the Division 2's coming out next week. If you like those looter shooters, and their roadmap looks a lot more impressive right now.
Nice. So, Curtis, can you just kind of fill us in on the steps involved with developing a video game?
Sure. Yeah. It's pretty similar to, I guess, making a movie, but all games start as someone's idea, a pitch. So, using something like BioWare as an example, you'd want to go in there and kind of come with an idea. You want to do something like a new IP, it's going to be a lot harder because you got to convince somebody that this new thing that no one has seen before is going to be just as good as a sequel to Dragon Age or Mass Effect. And usually your studio is going to give you the resources to put together a pretty small team. You get like a few designers, a couple engineers, some production folks, and you're going to work on what is generally called a vertical slice. And vertical slice is going to showcase all the key mechanics elements that is going to make your game better than any other game that's going to ship in the same year. Once you have that and it's polished, it's a nice little piece of everything you want to show off, you show that to the executives at your studio and they'll give you the thumbs up or the thumbs down.
Interesting. So it's like a pilot for a television show.
Yeah, okay. Very much. It's like if you're going to use like Uncharted, for example, your vertical slice would have like a big action scene. It'd have some platforming, some combat, and maybe like a cutscene to show like how people talk and be like, this is what we want to sell.
Okay.
But even if it's kind of you get the thumbs down, it's not necessarily bad. You usually just get a lot of notes like you would on a pilot to make some changes, add, oh, hey, this game's similar to Skyrim, so you should have some dragons in there as well, even if you didn't plan to have dragons. But if that's what it takes to get the game made, then usually you kind of go down that route. Once it is approved, you go into full production. Your team will ramp up to anywhere to about 100 to 600 people, depending on the size. And you spend the next couple of years aggressively building a video game, trying to get it done on time.
Right. Wow. What's the standard development cycle?
It can kind of change. Like in the games I've worked on, like big console games, you're usually about 2 to 5 years, depending on the size. But then if you look at like some of the sports titles like FIFA, NHL, they pump out a new one like in about 9 months. But there's not a lot of major updates to those.
Yeah, I feel like they just use the same general engine and they just kind of update update a couple things here and there.
Yeah, if you work in video games in Vancouver, chances are you've worked on a FIFA at least one point in your career. And yeah, you're just updating kits, making sure all the ads are correct, place things in the stadiums, making sure the grass is green. And moving on to the next one.
Someone's getting fired because the grass is not green today. Change colors.
Yeah. You'd be surprised. Some like people own the rights to those stadiums, so they'll see the air like, ooh, that adds a, like a foot off, or we don't have the color seats like that in that section. You got to change it all to like match this, or else you can't use that asset in the game.
Wow,
it has to be very realistic.
Yes.
Yeah, I that's another whole level of micromanaging that I don't think I would want to ever get into. Like on a film set, basically, you know, you listen to the director, and this is what he wants. And that's kind of all. He's kind of like the ultimate leader of everything. But I can imagine in a game like FIFA, you have obviously, I'm sure the director in the game and on the game is giving you feedback, plus engineers and all that, plus the people who own the rights to whatever you're working on are also giving you critiques like that. So you're getting it from different angles.
Yeah, I currently work on a Marvel game at Kabam, and every character we create, every piece of dialogue for any quest has to go through them, and it's. It can be very silly at times, the notes you get back from people like, oh, can you maybe make that ass not look so tight? Or can they not have a giant sword? Could they have a smaller sword? And I don't think Captain America would say this kind of dialogue. This doesn't line up with how he talks in the movies. So we need you to change it to something like this.
Right. Interesting. All right. So once we're in full production, then... kind of when you're coming to the end, I guess, like kind of into the alpha stage, it's not really the end, but I mean that's tail end of the full production cycle, I'd imagine.
Alpha usually means you're what they call feature complete, so every game mechanic that's going to be in your game is done, so you're not going to go back and suddenly rechange how driving works or combat. Like it's everything's now set in stone, and you're mostly just doing like tuning, polishing, making sure all the buildings look nice, character animations are good, and just kind of fine-tuning everything.
Nice. Is there anything between, like obviously there was the vertical slice you were talking about earlier, so is there anything in between that and the alpha that would is kind of like a stage in production?
Not like a major stage. Like you're going to have kind of gates or like a milestones, and they can be anywhere from a couple to from like vertical slice to alpha up to 20. But each of those gates are going to be kind of a gut check to make sure your project's on track, if there are things that are kind of taking too long. It's a big thing with video games is you can never really foresee problems that could happen. I always describe it as like the Springfield tire fire. It's always going to be burning. It's just a matter of how big the flames are today. And, you know, if you have to do something, you know, sometimes you'll read that a project has to switch their game engine. And anytime I read that, I know that's just a huge nightmare for a game team, because you're basically taking every tool they've been using for months and just basically saying, nope, this won't work anymore. You got to rebuild most of this in the new engine, and you got to stay on track.
Yeah, that's rough. Mm. That's rough. Yeah, I'm kind of curious right now because we were actually talking about Halo 6 in the last cast as well. And the new engine, their Slipspace engine that they're developing. I guess I didn't realize that the team at Halo, both Bungie and 343, were using the same engine since the first Halo. And then this is this is the brand new engine that they promised the development team that they're going to get.
Yeah, yeah. Some companies, you know, projects use this is the longer you can use your game engine, the easier it is, because you'll create a lot of custom tools for your engineer or even designers. And having to rework those tools in a new engine just is—it's not worth the cost at the time.
Yeah,
I think even like Apex Legends just came out, and it's using a modified version of the Source engine, which was built to make Half-Life.
Oh, interesting! Interesting.
Yeah.
Is that a very common engine, the Source?
Source is pretty common. Most studios, though, if you're EA, they have their own engine. They have the Frostbite, so like Anthem is built on that. Their sports titles, Battlefields. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies use the Unreal Engine, which is made by Epic. It's a pretty robust set of tools. They're an easy company to work with, so if you have any problems and something's not working, you can actually reach out and they'll help you work on it and then build you a new set of tools to use within their engine.
Wow.
At Kabam, we use the Unity Engine. It's mostly for mobile games. It can't really scale up for bigger projects, but you're starting to see more independent, like smaller studios use it for games because it's... You could essentially get it for free, and as long as you don't make so much profit once your game launches, you don't have to pay any fees to Unity, which is pretty nice.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, that's. I'm just thinking about that I can't code my way out of a paper bag. But, yeah, so just, like, I remember in high school, they're like, hey, make a web page, and, like, that was challenging. I made it in, like, Notepad or whatever. But, so I can't even imagine the amount of coding that goes into anything making a video game.
Yeah, your engineering department's probably going to be the largest chunk of people, because everything that has to go in the game needs some sort of a code, so...
Yeah,
basically having like 100 bakers all trying to bake the same cake, and they're just everyone's just tweaking each ingredient at the same time, and you're like, I hope it comes out okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that'd be super challenging.
When you develop a game, because you said you worked for BioWare as well, and I'm sure even with like mobile, either iOS or Android, how is it determined which system or console would it be going to?
Well, your console games, both like Sony and Microsoft, want your game on their console. It's going to help to sell hardware, but you're definitely going to have a platform that you're developing primarily for. so you see a lot of games, especially this generation, like the PlayStation will be like their key platform. So all their development will be done using that hardware as kind of the spec of how it'll operate. And then they'll start to port things over to Xbox or PC as they're going through development.
Okay. Yeah. Now, in development, does Sony, Microsoft, you know, Apple or whatnot get involved at all?
It would depend on the project. Like, if it's, say, obviously, like a first-party game like God of War, Sony's probably pretty involved. They're probably looking at the game at every milestone, making sure it's up to what they want to see. Mm-hmm. But when I was working on something at Radical Entertainment, I was working on Prototype 2, and Activision owned that studio, but they would come by roughly like every quarter just to see how things are going. And that was more just like a studio visit as well. Just come by, see how people are doing, how the project is, meet with our leadership team, like our studio, head of studios and all the executive producers. They give them a little demo of what the progress was, maybe get some notes, and then they'd be on their way.
Cool.
Interesting.
I have a quick question actually about the dev kits. So, for example, like the Xbox Scarlet, for example, that's coming out and no one knows a whole lot about. So they're going to need games to launch it with, so they're going to send dev kits out to the studios. So when you guys get dev kits of consoles that aren't released on the market yet, do they, from your experience, do they look like the actual finished product, or are they just like a bunch of circuit boards in like a little glass box?
It could be a bit of both. If it's like pretty far out from the release, you're just going to get just hardware. So it'll just be all the parts in a giant black box that weighs 100 pounds for no reason. But when I was at Microsoft, we actually started to see the Xbox One, but they had a zebra pattern on them for some weird reason. We all thought it was each pattern was different. So if a screenshot of the console or controller leaked, they could tell which studio it came from. But they were roughly the size of what the Xbox One was when it launched. They didn't perform very well. They overheated really quickly, so if you had anything kind of stacked on top of it, you'd just kill the console as you're testing on it or using it.
Oh yeah, interesting. So let's so you're the QA manager, so you're obviously managing all the quality assurance people. So what does a quality assurance person do? Me and Will know, but maybe our audience does not.
Easiest way to explain is they test video games. So cool. Sounds like the dream job, but they come in every day. They'll get kind of the latest build of the game. They'll work with they'll be assigned to like a team. So for example, like the combat team will have their own set of QA people, and they'll just come in every day, talk to the engineers, talk to the designers, and see what's ready, kind of open for testing. Because we do work in milestones, so you'll know, okay, this milestone is 3 weeks long. At the end of that, we need to deliver all the shooting mechanics for the game. So during those 3 weeks, they'll just be coming in and just focus just really on the shooting mechanics, writing up bugs, providing feedback, how does things work with other systems in the game. That's kind of one part of game testing. It's not quite, known is testers are at the end of the line, the production line, so they're one of the few groups in the company that'll see the entire game as one piece. If you're an engineer focused on gameplay and you have engineers that are focused on, say, the UI for a game, the UI engineers will probably never look at combat or else the entirety of the project. So when you're testing just combat, sometimes you got to go talk to the UI team, because sometimes it's this pop-up just suddenly appears in front of your face as you're trying to shoot people, and you got to go chase it down with a different team, because that's actually something they're working on, not the combat team.
Interesting. Is there a lot of "this is in my department"?
There can be, but I think it's not so much like done maliciously. It's more just people like, I have no idea what's causing this, so you'll have to go chase it down. But I find the nice thing is there is a lot of, we're all in it together. We all want to get the game shipped on time so we all can continue to make games. It can be, you know, especially at big studios, it can be pretty rough. If your game's not going to ship on time, you have to delay it. You're going to get a lot of pressure from your publishers or Sony or Microsoft coming to your door like every day, like, where is it? Where is it? Where is it? So if you need to kind of pitch in and help out another team to get something done, you'll generally find people more than willing to help.
So yeah, the QA department is kind of like the entry level position, I imagine.
It can, yeah, it is definitely the easiest way to break in. If you've gone to like a game design school or maybe have a computer science degree, you can usually break in as like a junior, like an entry level programmer or designer. There's a few different avenues, but even then, you know, I went to a game design school and you needed 2 years of experience to even get like a junior, like a entry level design position.
Right.
So I started on QA like most people do.
Okay. So I have this theory. I actually made a video about it on YouTube, but so there seems to be a lot of games getting pumped out on a 2 year development cycle, and it's not, it seems like the game has just a ridiculous amount of bugs, like kind of embarrassing, honestly, on day one of release. So I'm figuring that to nail that 2 year life cycle, they're basically pushing out the game and then not giving the QA department enough time to kind of go through the game with a fine tooth comb and kind of find all the little bugs. Is that kind of accurate?
Yeah, that's about half of it. I'd say the other half too is, you know, we don't get to fix all the bugs. That's just like, I've never worked on a project where like every single bug found was fixed, because you only have so much time. The production team, they're going to make the call. They're going to prioritize everything. If there's very low reproduced issues or just something that maybe 1% of users will find, they're more than likely to just kind of ship with that and maybe hopefully fix it in like a patch or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think some bugs are good. Like, you know, the old games where they obviously couldn't patch the game because once it was out, it was out. And, you know, they had to basically redo the whole cartridge.
Yeah.
You know, I like the finding bugs like that. Or even, like, in newer games, cool bugs that are, like, you know, out of bounds glitches and stuff like that. Those are really fun to explore.
Yeah, as when I play video games, like open world games, I'm always trying to find those ways to break the world. Like, oh, I wonder if I can squeeze through this wall and push myself out or start to find all those areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, that was like Halo.
Yeah. Halo is a great example, actually. Like, Halo 2 specifically, I remember the second mission. Well, I think it was the second mission where outskirts. And my friend's like, oh, hey, if you jump on this little light fixture, you can get out of bounds. And we're like, what? And then, like, we spent, like, days exploring out of bounds for outskirts. It was a lot of fun. So yeah, and it was nice before the internet too. You had to rely on your friends to be like, hey, by the way, you can glitch the game by doing this. And now it's just, yeah, like, you just type in, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2 glitches and there's a freaking whole list of them and how to do them and yada yada yada. So yeah. Okay, so next question we have for you is, I already asked you that. Film school, I discovered, because I went to film school, Film school, after I discovered, after entering the film industry, was a complete waste of time and money. Does one really need to go to school to break into the industry?
I guess I mentioned earlier, it really depends on the role. There's so many different kind of hats you can wear. So if you wanted to be an engineer, you would definitely need some sort of computer science backgrounds. Design, usually probably a good idea to go to a game design school just to learn some of the basics and kind of the problem solving part of it. But if you want to get into QA or production, you could probably just get an entry level position, just kind of work your way up.
Cool. Yeah, I figured that was the case too. So yeah, so what, depending on what you want to do, you kind of just have to research, you know, what skills you need, I guess.
Yeah, like, yeah. I went to a game school here in Vancouver. It was like a just over a year long program, and it didn't quite help me get a job, but it got me a lot of contacts, and that's how I got my first job. But I never ended up getting into. I wanted to be a level designer originally. I never got into that. I just stuck with QA.
Yeah, that's kind of similar to me. I went to film school, and they taught you how to make your own film, not necessarily how to work on a big show. But once that got me contacts, and then I got in. and basically it streamlined my my whole career, because I was able to move up way quicker, because I obviously was smart and figured it all out way quicker than everybody else. And so yeah, that kind of helped me in a way too. So that's kind of the one thing about film school that was nice. But if you're listening and you're thinking about going to film school to just get into the film industry, it's a complete waste of time and money. Save your 30 grand. So awesome. So for the big roles, so say obviously like the director of the game or the general producer or any of those big games, even the like the level design or anything like that, what is the route that one needs to take to break into that?
Well, most people that work in production actually started in QA. It's kind of a weird trend. A lot of the producers I know all were working in like EA QA 20 odd years ago when they first opened that studio. A lot of the level designers, design is a pretty broad, I guess, job. There's so many different, like you can be a level designer, you can design just the economy, RPG stats. So it's just kind of where is your level. One of the RPG designers I work with now just grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons and writing scenarios all the time. And now he does that for a job in video games.
Nice.
So it's more just trying to find like what is your passion, as corny as that sounds, and just kind of sticking to it. You don't want to be like, I'll be a designer, and then just try and do as many different design roles as possible, because you'll never really move up. You'll always just be kind of that mid-tier kind of designer. Most of the big game directors now all focus on one type of game, one area, and just really own that, kept doing it, got better and better at it, and now they're game directors.
Interesting. So, for example, Will and I like to complain about games. Is there a department that hones that skill?
Probably the community teams, because you got to deal with like fans going to forums. So they're kind of the face of all the complaints of everyone who loves to play your game, but at the same time spends just as much time crapping on it.
True, yeah. So, for example, if I was on the production team for Anthem, and they said, hey, we have Fort Tarsus, and then we have a completely open world, completely separate from Fort Tarsus. Is there a way where I could be like, that sounds really stupid, you should just do this, this, and that, and it would be way better?
Yeah, you'd probably be like one of the producers, and probably, yeah, probably a producer, because you're going to have, you know, the designers be like, oh, we got this really cool first-person mode, you're going to come in, you can go and talk to people and be just like a BioWare game. And then you'll probably have a lead engineer who tells you, like, this is not going to work technically. There's going to be so many loading screens because you're going from third person to first person. And that world is so detailed, we just can't load it fast enough for you to move at a speed that's not a slow walk. And then we're like, producer, what do you want to do? And they'll have to make the call.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, I think working for Nintendo would just be super fun. Like, they just, everyone who works at Nintendo looks like they just absolutely love their job.
Yeah.
So, have you done anything in relation to them with at all or no?
No. That's kind of like the holy grail. There's a couple studios here in Vancouver that do work with Nintendo, but you got to know somebody who's been there for years to even get in the door. It's
right.
Pretty tough.
Right. Doug Bowser didn't have to try very hard. He just said, "My name's Doug Bowser," and they're like, "You're fucking
yeah.
hired."
That's true.
So
he's got pretty big shoes to fill, though. Reggie's a legend. So
yeah, for sure. The Muppet Show at E3 was my favorite moment ever, of like Miyamoto and Anuma and Reggie, all as Muppets, singing. Oh, I died.
Yeah.
So funny.
If you go to the Nintendo store in New York, they have all those Muppets on display in the cases.
Oh, really?
It's pretty cool, yeah.
I was just in New York. That's disappointing. Shit. Could have saw Muppets. All right, anyways. So, what's your kind of long-term career plan with the game industry? Are you hoping to kind of move up, or are you kind of happy where you are?
I'm pretty happy where I've been the QA manager at Kabam for just about a year, so I'm still having a lot of fun, still really like the role. It's close enough to still be involved with the games, each of the projects, and work closely with, you know, the producers and team leads, which I really enjoy. So having I do get to sit in those meetings where they make the decision, should we have a Fort Tarsus or not, and give them some feedback on why that could be a good idea or be a really bad idea.
Yeah.
So I really like being that involved. I think kind of the next step would be, I'd be just the people pressure. I'd just be doing paperwork all day, which I do spend a lot of time doing now, looking at spreadsheets and numbers, but just that would be, I'd be so disconnected from what the actual projects are doing, which I definitely would miss.
Right. And so are you the department head, or is there one more above you?
There is one more above me, the QA director. And yeah, he works with all the studios. So I work in the Vancouver studio. We have a development studio in Austin that's just starting up. And we also are owned by a Korean gaming company called Netmarble. So I basically am the QA manager for Vancouver, and then we'll have a QA manager in Austin. And then he also works with Korea if they have any questions or want to see how we do things, or if there's any kind of tools or tips and tricks we can share with each other.
Right.
He travels a lot to go visit these places. And so I just stay here and make sure Vancouver doesn't burn to the ground.
Right. So he kind of liaises between all the different studios, make sure kind of the standards kind of upkept, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Okay.
The traveling sounds nice, but every time I see him, he's pretty tired.
Yeah, I bet, yeah. Jet lagged all the time. Awesome. So, Will, you have a question for him, I'm sure, yeah?
Yeah, I was going to go more into where his passion for gaming actually began.
Yeah.
Yeah, just really growing up playing video games. My dad came home from a business trip with a Nintendo and a copy of Super Mario Brothers 3 and a golf game. I'm trying to think. Jack Nicklaus Golden Bear Golf. And I would watch him play golf because he really liked that game. And then whatever chance I got to play Mario Brothers, it just kind of took off from there.
Yeah, I mean,
that, playing games.
I mean,
that, pretty much my entire life.
Yeah, that golf game's a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I was definitely a Nintendo kid, so I had Nintendo, moved on to Super Nintendo, had pretty much every Nintendo console since they started making them.
Yeah, same as me. Same as Rodney.
Yeah. Pretty well. So, awesome. So what's your go-to game right now?
The one I'm playing the most, I was playing a lot of Anthem this last couple of weeks, but waiting for The Division 2. I really like looter shooters right now, really into the multiplayer side of them, so we'll be picking up The Division 2, but Apex Legends, I've been playing a lot of that, which was a really pleasant surprise.
Yeah. It's amazing that it, like, basically within 2 weeks, it, like, took over Fortnite. It just, like, pushed it aside. It's like, move aside.
Yeah.
Way better.
Yeah. 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 I feel bad for Anthem after that game came out. They're both published by EA. Anthem was touted for years of being this next big looter shooter. Came out kind of disappointing. Nobody even heard of Apex Legends. They launch it, and just everybody loves it.
Yeah. But, I mean, Fortnite was also... It was building upon its single player, and then it just happened to make a Battle Royale mode, and it just happened to be fun, so everyone was on board with that. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think with Anthem, like, when Will and I played the beta, we were stoked. Like, we thought the game was going to be freaking awesome. And
yeah, I have a ton of fun with that, like, the flying around, shooting stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of stuff, like we were talking about earlier, when you're in suit, there's a lot of stuff that just feels so good, like the flight, the controls are they're so fluent and so easy to get, and there's a couple of great things about Anthem that are making it a really good game, but at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that are dragging it down, like Fort Tarsus, basically.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're just going to cut that from the game. I'm sure everybody's complaining about Fort Tarsus, like... Actually, that's a big move.
Hard to say, because you still need a place to turn in quests, right?
Well, I know, but you have the launch pad, and it's also your social hub. So, like, Fort Tarsus is a complete waste of time. So, yeah. What were you going to say there, Curtis?
I assume, like, once you kind of hit the end game in a lot of those shooters, there's just areas you never go to. Like, Destiny 2 had the farm, and once you finish the story, you never go back to that area.
Yeah. That's
They'll just
true.
Probably end up putting something that's like a better version of Fort Tarsus.
Yeah.
Like the launch pad, but with a bit more, maybe some actual people in there, something you could chat to.
Yeah, and the other thing I mentioned in the last cast too, which is super annoying, is if you finish a mission, it takes you directly back to Fort Tarsus, but what if you wanted to go to do free play? So now you have to wait for Fort Tarsus to load, and then you have to turn around, get back in your javelin, wait for the fucking... the mission screen to load, select free play, and then wait for a long loading screen to go back and free play. So it's like they could have just added the option to, like, hey, you're done the mission, do you want to just enter free play or return to Fort Tarsus? You know what I mean? Like, one simple screen would have just fixed all that.
Yeah. Yeah, we kind of have a joke at work where we love to sit on the postmortem. Every game that launches, once it's out the door, your entire team will kind of sit down and go over what could have we done better, you know, now right. that we're done.
Right.
And just there's so many questions I have for them to be like, why did you decide to do it this way?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we at the end of the show, we just kind of drink and say that show fucking sucked. And then like we got through it, so we kind of like bond over drinks.
The rap party.
Yeah, the rap party, and then some people don't remember it because they were so high or drunk or whatever. And yeah, that's basically it. And then we start the next show and we go, hey, remember that show we just worked on? It was shit. And then we just bitch about it. That's kind of our
answer.
Then
when it gets another season, you just go back.
Yeah.
I've been pretty lucky not to work on really any game I didn't like. There was one project at EA. They had a series of fitness games, and they had to make one more as like a contractual obligation, and that was the last game I ever worked on at EA. But the entire team, we spent most of our day honestly just playing NHL.
Nice.
It wasn't really... It was a weird project. It was a fitness game, but they legally couldn't make you do anything that would raise your heart rate. Because if you were out of shape, that could cause you to have a heart attack. So they didn't want people dying while playing this fitness game. So everything was like super low key, just like doing 10 jumping jacks. And that was like your whole, that was it. You won for the day. Come back tomorrow. Do 10 more.
Wow. I'm shocked they didn't just get you to sign a waiver. Like by signing this, you certify that you're at least competently in shape to do 10 jumping jacks a day. Oh man, that's funny. Fitness game and you can't get a heart rate. Oh, that's funny. I've been thinking about possibly jumping over. Like a couple of years ago I was thinking about jumping over, but I didn't want to play the game. I didn't want to go into the game industry because right now watching movies is ruined for me. Will can probably agree with this, because you'll sit down and watch the movie and the whole freaking movie we won't watch what's going on, like in the narrative story. We'll say, oh, like the lighting sucks, or why the hell, or that location would be a nightmare to shoot at, or something like that. Like we would just kind of dissect it, and then at the end of the movie you're like, what the fuck happened to the movie? Like we didn't watch it. So that's kind of the one thing that's stopping me from jumping over into the game industry, because I'm afraid that it'll ruin video games for me. So is that something you find working in the game industry?
It hasn't quite ruined them. I think at times, you know, if I play like a big game, like Red Dead Redemption 2, like there's just moments that game where I just was blown away. Even knowing, kind of seeing like the man behind the curtain, how it's all made, there's stuff they pull off in that game. It clearly took millions of dollars and hundreds of man hours to do, and they just nailed it. But then there are other times I play games, I just shake my head like, why couldn't they have done this a little bit differently? Mm-hmm. Mostly like the first like big party titles, anything from say Sony, Red Dead Redemption, obviously, so Rockstar, those games are always good. They I can play those games and not really get pulled into how it was made. But playing some of the smaller games, or like I play a lot of NHL, and that game just nothing but frustrated me. I don't really know why I keep buying it, but year in, year out, I find the same issues, the same problems. I know people that work on that game. I ask them every year, why can't I still do this in the game? Like, we just don't have the time.
Yeah. Yeah, 9-month development period. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, they release NHL 19 in like freaking July or September of 2018. So it's like, why don't you just push it to December and then release it in January? That'd be ideal.
Then look at Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I had to stop playing those the Ubisoft open world games. I just had to give up on. It's just every single one I played was the same. It's just now you're the watchdog in Chicago. Now you're an assassin in Rome.
You know, I kind of felt that way too. After playing the first two, and yeah, so I kind of lost interest. Black Flag kind of reignited my passion for Assassin's Creed, because it was different. It wasn't just running through freaking buildings. You're a goddamn pirate, for fuck's sakes.
Yeah, the pirate stuff was fun. Listen to sea shanties.
Yeah,
those are great.
Yeah, and then obviously Origins. I'm really into the ancient culture, so ancient Egypt's my favorite one. So that game was like, Rodney, come play ancient Egypt.
Yeah, for me, it was Odyssey with Greece. I was blown away.
Yeah, so it is basically the same old, like, climb this, synchronize viewpoint this, whatever the fuck, but I mean, the overall gameplay experience felt much better than like 3 or what was the other ones, Will? I can't even remember.
After Black Flag, there was Unity, and then that other one with that they went to London.
Yeah, I didn't play that one.
Like, I can't remember. I never played it. We had the siblings.
Yeah. So yeah, those ones don't interest me, but yeah, they caught my attention with Origins and Odyssey, for sure.
I would love for them to go to like feudal Japan. Like, it's the one area that just screams Assassin's Creed.
Oh, dude,
I wouldn't
that
be surprised if that's next.
Well, what other ancient culture do they have? They have like Rome. That's about it. But no, ancient Japan would be sick. Actually, like being ancient samurai, that'd be so fucking awesome.
Yeah, running on the rooftops, swing building to building.
Yeah, and that's a bit different because they basically stuck to European stories. You know, it's been European cities or I mean, I guess the Caribbean, but still, it's been mostly Western stuff. So, yeah, it'd be nice to go over to Japan and run around in buildings and stab people with a samurai sword. So, all right, so moving on here. So right now, I was playing Apex today, actually, and actually I'm trying to time this out right so that I just go upstairs after the podcast, say goodnight to the wife, and then come back down and play with Will. So if you're down, Will.
We'll see. I got to get up for like 4 o'clock in the morning. So.
Oh, okay, you're fucking out then. Well, I'll play anyway. But anyway, so I'm actually quite curious to know a little bit more about the QA side of things, because so when you're playing the game, do they get separate parts of the game? So like if you have, you know, if you say, for example, the entire alphabet is the game, do you hand off A to somebody and then B to somebody, or do they play each part on their own and then go all the way to Z and then kind of report all the bugs?
You'll kind of get the entire, so we're using the alphabet. You'll, 1 week we'll have just letter A, and the second week they've added B, so now we're actually looking at both A and B, and just as they keep stacking in new letters, we just have the alphabet just gets bigger and bigger for us. Most of the time you're focused on what's the newest letter being added, but then you have to always go back to make sure you can still get from A to L.
Right.
Just make sure it's still working.
Do they ever throw a curveball and you're doing A, B, C, and then they throw in like W and you're like, what the fuck? Like, it's, you know what I mean? Do they just do it in linear order?
That can definitely happen. If you have a team working on a really cool new feature and they get it done early, they need to move on. They're like, we're done. We got to get this in because we got to move on to the next section. So I've been on projects where it's happened. It's like, oh, there's this whole section of the game that's done, but we can't technically reach it because there's no way to get to that part. But it's there, and we could use some debug tools to load it. It looks cool. Okay, everyone back to the start of the alphabet.
Interesting. So what's kind of the job duties that a QA tester does, besides obviously playing the game?
They're pretty involved. There's kind of two, I guess, entry-level roles. You have someone we call like a black box tester, and they just come in, sit at their desk, and run through like a series of checks. They'll have to do those checks by the end of the day. They'll have different checks every day. And then there's more of what they call like a white box tester, who kind of just experiments with what's available. So they don't necessarily start at a checklist and go from top to bottom. They'll get the new letter for the day and they'll just go in and see what they can find. And they get that information talking with designers, with engineers, going to a lot of like meetings to look and preview some of the stuff that they're working on. So as it's coming online, they just automatically start looking into new features, new combat mechanics, maybe cars got introduced, so let's see if we can drive a car and what can this car do now that's in the game. Can I drive through walls? Can I take it off a cliff?
All that
kind of stuff.
So is that your responsibility to make the black box checklist?
Not as the manager. So the teams would have like a lead or a senior person, the senior QA,
right?
And they will be tasked with kind of creating all those test scripts.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. So, what's the other job you mentioned? There was two. So,
would be more like the white box tester. So instead of a checklist, you're just kind of going in like freeform. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Cool. And then they find a bug, and then they go, "Oh, what happened? How did I create the bug?" And they got to do a little report or whatever.
Yeah, they'll drop a little bug report. You'll try and obviously see if you can reproduce it easily. So if it's something that's 100% every time you do these exact steps, game crashes. they'll fix that right away. If it's a like a one-off, which can happen a lot, especially when you're getting closer to alpha, where like the game is feature complete, and you'll just find like random things in the world. I worked on a game, an open world game, where it wasn't until well into the alpha that we found that there was one barricade that if you were to try and pick it up, the entire game would crash.
Oh.
It's like, why this one barricade? Every other barricade in the map was fine, but just this one. So that, yeah, you'll run into that kind of stuff all the time. So then you have to like figure out, okay, that's 100%, but it's this one specific barricade. So try not to put a lot of missions around this area of the map until we fix this.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be qualified to be a QA tester because I just get angry when I either some sort of bug happens or the game crashes. So
yeah, I used to have a lead who when I was starting out who described as like listening to your favorite song on repeat, and then the next day you come in and only listen to the last half on repeat, and then the third day you listen only the first half of that song on repeat. It's like, if you can handle that, then you could probably start out in QA.
I think that would age me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fine. I mean, sorry, go ahead.
How, like, what are the hours like for the office?
They can kind of vary project to project. Where I'm at now, it's pretty nice. The culture is very important to them, and they're really into like a life work balance. So, we're generally about 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, so about 40 hour weeks. Obviously, there can be crunch time. It's a word you hear a lot, where you're trying to hit a deadline and you're far behind, so you just got to put in some extra time. When I first started out, I was working on FIFA. My first job, first day, was 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, just playing FIFA.
That sounds kind of illegal.
That's actually
kind of is illegal. most people in the video game industry count as like working in the tech industry, so there's a lot of gray area around overtime, things like that. Some places you will get paid overtime. Some places you get paid just a pretty nice salary, and if you have to work a little extra time, then it's just something you do. But again, where I work now, we have, like I said, beer on tap, kombucha, cold brew. They'll buy you dinner.
Okay, so they reward for good behavior. They don't just expect you to bend over backwards. Okay, that's nice.
Yeah.
So in our industry, we don't get rewarded for good behavior. You just put in another 16-hour day the next day.
Yeah, you get rewarded with going to bed and getting up and coming back to work.
Yeah, when I first started out at EA, it was pretty rough. I know it's gotten a lot better in the 10 years that I've been in the industry, but yeah, there'd be days you just, you know, you'd be trying to final. I was working on NHL, and we were working till like 4 in the morning, and they came just like, well, PlayStation's still not ready to test, so you can go home, but be back here in 2 hours.
Yeah.
So most of us just found a couch, took a nap, got back up, and yeah, he said put another 16 hours just to get the other platform tested, signed off on, and then call it a day.
So what is the, I guess, standard entry-level rate for a QA tester?
That's a good question. It's definitely going to vary. Some places you'll be hourly, depending if you're like a contractor, so that can range like, I want to say like $12 to $15 an hour. But a lot of bigger studios, they'll put you on a salary, and you're probably looking around $40,000 to $42,000 a year.
So if I use my handy dandy computer in my hand, let's see here, what is that? So it's like $800 a week. So that's not bad. That's pretty good, actually. That's like less than PA rate, Will.
Yeah, if you're right. If you have a salary position too, like they'll be pretty good. You'll probably get like benefits. Some companies even have like a profit sharing. So if your game does really well, it hits a certain Metacritic, sells X amount of copies, everyone in the studio gets a nice bonus because you hit your targets for your publisher.
Nice. Okay. So yeah, because the reason I'm asking is because you're here selling it really well, and film sucks. Film sucks ass. So
yeah, we're both trying to get out.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you might as well jump onto something where you know doing something we love. So, but yeah, and you said that you have time to play lots of games still, so that's good actually.
I do. Yeah. I probably just come home most days and put in a couple of hours.
Yeah.
It was nice. My girlfriend was getting her master's degree, so she was always doing homework for like the last 6 years. So I just sat down beside her and just played video games all day.
Nice. Yeah, I'm going to have a hard time with that because I'll be at work doing work. And like, I mean, maybe playing games, whatever, but I'll come home and then I'll want to play like a full, complete released game. And she'll be like, but you play video games all day at work. So now it's my turn to spend time with you. And I'll be like, fuck, I want to play games. Basically. So, yeah, she's not doing her master's. So she's usually home when I get home already because I work, obviously, stupid hours. But yeah. Anyways, Will, you got any more questions?
In the next little while, what is the big games that you're looking forward to? Not maybe not a little while, but like this year, next year, whatever's been announced.
Yeah, like I mentioned, Division 2 is coming out next week. I've been looking forward to that. But I think other than that, there's a couple big Sony games. I'm just waiting for like dates on. There's the one from, I want to say Sucker Punch, the Ghost of Tsushima.
Yeah.
That looks really awesome. We have a standing bet on when Death Stranding will get a release date.
I say this year at E3.
Yeah. I want them just to announce it's a PlayStation 5 game and just, I don't know, say it'll come out when it's ready.
Yeah.
I'd also really like them to announce the release date for Cyberpunk 2077. I just bought a brand new PC specifically to play that game. Even though they haven't announced any kind of specs for anything, I just want to get my hands on that.
Yeah, Project Red is going to do a great job on that game for sure. I love The Witcher.
Yeah, Witcher 3 was all the DLC for that game was really well done. So I'm really looking forward to what they do with Cyberpunk.
Definitely.
So I think other than those, though, I have a Switch as well, so I'm looking forward for them to announce the new Animal Crossing. Probably check out the new Fire Emblem as well.
Luigi's Mansion 3. Stoked.
Yep. Yeah.
So this
Pokemon.
Is Pokemon Sword and Shield. And yeah, that's going to be good. So this is just a shot in the dark. But do you have a dev kit for you work at Kabam, which is mobile. So never mind, you don't. I was going to ask if you have a dev kit for the Scarlet and if you could say if it was cool or not.
No, I haven't seen it. No. I guess companies that are working on games will probably have seen it by now, but I know some people that work at EA and they might be working on it because usually if they've had it for a couple, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen what it looks like, but no one I know is even talking about it. So I assume they're just getting them if they are.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? Are we going to get new consoles this year?
I think they announced something. I think both consoles have been out for about 5-6 years, which is pretty average lifespan.
Yeah.
I'd like them to see to go almost fully digital.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I buy all my games digitally, so I might just have a preference, but
yeah, me and Will like the hard copies for two reasons. One, it's nice to hold the physical game in your hand, and two, when you hate it, you can take it back.
That's true. Yeah, you can only ever return one game on the PSN, and I've done that already, so
yeah.
Kind of hoping to buy something.
Collector's editions for me.
Yeah. I would like to see Sony, I think, if they really wanted to keep their advantage, if they, with the PlayStation 5, if with your kind of PlayStation Plus membership, they also gave you access to the PlayStation Now service. So all your games could technically be backwards compatible. You just stream them online.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would work. How much is, I know I had it before, but the streaming service, isn't it still like $14 or $15 a month?
Yeah, it's not too bad. That's why I feel it's cheap enough, they could just slide it in there.
It would definitely be a good incentive for early adapters to the next console.
Yeah. Because I know the Nintendo, I don't have their live service, but I always see the games are adding. It's slowly starting to build up.
Yeah, they don't have a ton of a game catalog in terms of retro stuff. But, I mean, I was playing the original Mario Bros. And sucking ass at it. It was the last cast, I think. It was early cast before we were talking about classic games that, or no, yeah, it was me and Bradley two podcasts ago. We were talking about games we played when we were kids, like NES, SNES, and 64 games that we just like cruise through like no problem. And then now we play them after playing the new 3D A++ graphics era, and we just can't even manage to get through the first couple levels without getting frustrated.
Oh yeah, I remember very much beating every Mega Man growing up, and I go and try and play Mega Man 2 now, and it's It's a frustrating experience.
Yeah. So what about mobile games? Do you play a lot of those or no?
I do. Yeah, because I work in a mobile company. It's always good to see what other people are doing. I try to play mostly betas, stuff that's just kind of soft launch, so it's only available in a couple countries, because those are usually, you know, they're going to have like the newest kind of mechanics or kind of
right.
The newest kind of trends in mobile games.
Okay. Nice. What about, what's your go-to?
I just finished playing Donut Country. It's not a free game. You have to purchase it, but it's pretty cool. You just control a hole and things fall into it, but it's got a really, really good soundtrack.
Nice.
Just a nice, easy, casual game to sit back and just kind of turn off your brain.
Awesome. Mine, I think, the toilet passer is what I call it, is Clash of Clans.
Yeah.
Classic. But, and Pokemon, well, Will and I play Pokemon Go still. And I got back into Balloon Tower Defense 6. That's what I've been playing. So, it's a good time.
I've been playing a lot of puzzles.
Yeah. Yeah, Brick Breaker is another one. That's a puzzle one. Balloon Tower Defense 6 is super fucking frustrating, though. Because you can lose it all in one round. Like, even if you have everything under control, like, if you're on round, like, 80, and you have absolutely everything under control in round 80, round 81 will just fucking destroy you, and you're like, what just happened? Like, you don't even have enough time to kind of fix it. So, yeah, that's frustrating, but it's still a fun time killer. Yeah. All right, guys. So, I think that's it for today. So, thanks a lot, Curtis, for joining us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
It was a lot of fun. And hey, everybody, you were probably wondering why this episode was released on Tuesday instead of Monday. That's because all podcasts will be uploaded to Patreon for our Patreon supporters to listen to first, and then everything will be released on Tuesday after that. So if you want access to our episodes one day early, check out our Patreon. And we also have a Discord that's been super chatty with our new team members. And we want you guys to jump on there. You can ask questions for future podcasts or basically talk about games. It's going to be a good old time. So thanks a lot, guys, for listening today. Jump on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and all those fun things to let us know what you thought of the show and to maybe suggest a topic for future shows. Thanks a lot, guys, and we'll see you all on the next one. Bye-bye. Will.
Bye.
'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.